just a baby. Before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal numbered shelf to every decimal numbered spine. I'm a librarian, 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 I'm a librarian.
Good morning and welcome to the Library Show. My name is Brooke, and I am a librarian, at least some of the time, and I'm your host this morning as well. I'll be with you for about a half an hour talking with my guest about books, I think mostly books today, but we love to talk about books and audiobooks, music, movies, pretty much whatever you like to check out from the library. And welcome, Brandy Cheatham. She's my guest today. It's great to have you here. Before we start talking about your books, I'd like to let the listeners know that if you are listening today and maybe you don't have a pen nearby and you hear about a book that you would love to investigate further, you can find the names of the books on our Facebook page. You can go to the Library Show on Facebook, and we'll have a list of the things that we talk about today and with all of our other guests. There are also links there to get to the Sitka Public Library, so you can investigate what is available for you to check out if you are a library patron. And you can also connect over to Raven Radio, where you can hear back issues of our shows. We might even have a link on there to Old Harbor Books, where you can purchase things if you live here in Sitka. So do check out our Library Show, and I will plug that you can message us there. So if you have a book that you've been reading and would just love to talk about it, share it with Sitka and listeners across Southeast, then you should send us a message and we will get back to you about scheduling a time to be on this show with us. So it's enough promotion, I think. I think instead we're going to move over to talking to Brandy about what you have in your book bag today.
Ooh, fantastic. Hello. I'm glad you had me. I was wondering if my qualifications were that I'm a part-time librarian. I sub at the library. I'm a lover of books, but it might have been just that I said yes, that I would be on the Library Show. So anyone else out there, you too could say yes. That's the qualification.
Absolutely.
I have a really random mix of books. I brought When Women Were Birds from Terry Tempest Williams, Committed from Elizabeth Gilbert, Bonk from Mary Roach. And who knows where we'll get to with all of these, but just to give you the random mix, The Strange and Beautiful Sorrows of Ava Lavender by Leslie Walton are the kind of four I picked.
This sounds fantastic, I have to say. I've heard of all of those books except the last one you mentioned. So, and actually one of them, the first one, When Women Were Birds, was a book that you lent me. So I'm a little more familiar with that book. And I remember I was intrigued by it, or you recommended it to me, because I was talking to you about thoughts I have about silence and like when you keep things silent and when you talk about things and what that does to us as human beings, like what kinds of secrets we keep or just silences we hold, and when it's a good idea to talk and when it's not a good idea to talk. And
yeah, exactly. That's what got me so excited when we were having that conversation hiking. I'm like, you must read When Women Were Birds, because it's, if any of you have read Refuge, that's the book she's most well known for. She just has a beautiful voice, and hearing someone who so eloquently writes her thoughts talk about how you find your voice. And within like this meditation on her mother's journals, which I don't want to do any spoilers. But yeah, it's just amazing how there's kind of this revisiting what her mother's journals meant. But throughout it all, it's this finding a voice. And so it's a fantastic read. I don't know.
Do you have, I don't know if I want to put you on the spot to say a favorite section, because that might be hard to choose, but maybe you did choose. Do you have a section from it that you would want to read?
Or? Yeah. Yeah. There was one, I don't want to do a spoiler, but there's just this amazing, it's not really a spoiler. You find out fairly early on that her mother's journals are blank. Mm-hmm. And it's this pretty amazing, powerful way that she writes in you know, how it felt to find them blank, and then allows the reader to experience that as well. So I'm just going to leave that a little bit mysterious. But that was the first thing that struck me. But I was kind of trying to think about which piece really summed up what she's getting at in a lot of the little stories that she tells in here. And so I picked this short passage, and here it is. For far too long, we have been seduced into walking a path that did not lead us to ourselves. For far too long, we have said yes when we wanted to say no. And for far too long, we have said no when we desperately wanted to say yes. When I look in the mirror, I see a woman with secrets. When we don't listen to our intuition, we abandon our souls. And we abandon our souls because we are afraid if we don't, others will abandon us. We've been raised to question what we know, to discount and discredit the authority of our gut. I want to know why. I regret whenever I abandon myself. But harboring regrets is making love to the past, and there is no movement here. It's not the lips of a prince that will save us, but our own lips speaking.
Wow. That section is pretty powerful, I think.
Yeah, I love the last line. I love this like interjection, almost this like fairy tale. Oh, you know, kiss a prince, but it's like, yeah, it's your own voice speaking. Yeah, it's that is the one that's like, bam, that's what this book is about in all the little ways. But that is kind of the piece that most powerfully demonstrates to me that, find your voice. But it doesn't really offer any solutions or answers. It's just this someone asking the same questions, which somehow is more reassuring because we don't really have the answers anyway. So
I kind of loved that about the book, like the fact that there was no resolution, I would say, at the end, like, okay, and now here are the steps you too can go through to kind of find your voice and like figure things out. It was really what I felt was kind of like it began as a meditation on her mom's journals. And an exploration into silence and the times she's been silent and what just wanting to know why, like you read in that passage, like questioning.
Yeah. And it's just demonstrated throughout in different ways and in different little chapters of her life or ways that she's found voice or how that plays out in her marriage. And yeah, it's fantastic read. So yeah. I recommend it to anyone.
And that one is by Terry Tempest Williams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny that like the subtitle even says 54 variations on voice, which you're just kind of like, what does that mean? And,
right.
And then you read it and you're like, oh, I see.
I didn't know there were 54 variations. I thought I had just one voice. So what else do you have there in front of you, Brent?
Well, I'm kind of like going maybe to the less intense. That seemed like the most kind of intense, serious subjects. And this one, Committed, A Love Story by Elizabeth Gilbert. And she's the one folks best know for writing Eat, Pray, Love.
Mm-hmm.
And
have you read that one?
I read that one.
Okay.
Yeah, I like that one as well. So that's how I recognized her name, you know, because sometimes you're like, I don't know what author to pick. But hey, I read that other book and that was good. And what's really neat is that so she read this after writing Eat, Pray, Love, which was a huge success to the point of, you know, a movie starring Julia Roberts, which definitely means it's, you know, hit the big screen. And what sucked me in, and sometimes I admit I skip the, like, notes to the readers or the acknowledgments because you're like, yeah, let's just get to the meat of the book. But this, it was actually that section that first really kind of got me hooked. Because she's talking about how, and I've heard this on a podcast since, like most people are like, well, don't you feel like your greatest success is behind you? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you even write another book after that? And it's like, wow, that's a horrible question to ask someone. And so she's thinking about this and she writes this draft and she writes in this beginning, in the end, I found a certain comfort in recognizing that I cannot write a book that would satisfy millions of readers, not deliberately anyhow. The fact is, I do not know how to write a beloved bestseller on demand. And so she writes, and hopefully this isn't too long, but this is what really like brought me in. So she says, for a multitude of personal reasons then, the book that I needed to write was exactly this book, another memoir with extra social historical bonus sections about my efforts to make peace with the complicated institution of marriage. The subject matter was never in doubt. It's just that I had trouble there for a while finding my voice. Ultimately, I discovered that the only way I could write again at all was to vastly limit, at least in my own imagination, the number of people I was writing for. So I started completely over, and I did not write this version of Committed for millions of readers. Instead, I wrote it for exactly 27 readers. To be precise, the names of those 27 readers are, and she goes on and to list these, and then she says, these 27 women constitute my small but critically important circle of female friends, relatives, and neighbors. Kind of describes them and just says, like, over many years, over many cups of tea and booze, I have sat with one or another of these dear souls and wondered aloud over questions of marriage, intimacy, sexuality, divorce, fidelity, family, responsibility, and autonomy. This book was built on the bones of those conversations. So I love the fact that she just thought, like, here's the people I'm writing for. I can't write for all these people. Here's, like, these 27 women who are, like, are my core people. And I was like, okay, that's what I want to read.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually, I mean, it sounds fantastic just from the little piece you read. Is it exactly what she explains? Is it really this kind of exploration about just those things?
Yeah. So she has this experience where her partner, who she meets after her divorce, is whatever legality, stupid stuff. Gantz is like the great summary. He needs to leave the country. And so the way that he could stay was by being married. And they both agreed that after their previous entanglements with marriage and what that ended up with, that they never wanted to go there again. Mm-hmm. And so she has this serious kind of really, just kind of picks it apart and looks at it and talks to people about, like, what is it that I have against this institution of marriage, and gives these great historical accounts of, like, what it has been in the past, which would seriously make any woman question going into it, mm-hmm. and what it is in other cultures, and just really explores, like, why am I against this? How could I make it work for me? There's this other piece in here that I kind of think really resonated with me in terms of how, just one of the ways that she kind of summarizes, or one of the things that was brought to light as she was doing this research. Shall I read it?
Yeah,
okay.
Please.
So she writes, but maybe it would be more useful for me to at least acknowledge to myself on the eve of my second marriage that I too ask for an awful lot. Of course I do. It's the emblem of our times. I have been allowed to expect great things in life. I have been permitted to expect far more out of the experience of love and living than most other women in history were ever permitted to ask. When it comes to questions of intimacy, I want many things from my man, and I want them all simultaneously. It reminds me of a story my sister once told me about an English woman who visited the United States in the winter of 1919 and who, scandalized, reported back home in a letter that there were people in this curious country of America who actually lived with the expectation that every part of their bodies should be warm at the same time. My afternoon spent discussing marriage with the Hmong made me wonder if I, in matters of the heart, had also become such a person, a woman who believed that my lover should magically be able to keep every part of my emotional being warm at the same time. We Americans often say that marriage is hard work. I'm not sure the Hmong would understand this notion. Life is hard work, of course, and work is very hard work. I'm quite certain they would agree with those statements. But how does marriage become hard work? Here's how. Marriage becomes hard work once you have poured the entirety of your life's expectations for happiness into the hands of one mere person. Keeping that going is hard work. A recent survey of young American women found that what women are seeking these days in a husband, more than anything else, is a man who will inspire them, which is, by any measure, a tall order. As a point of comparison, young women of the same age surveyed back in the 1920s were more likely to choose a partner based on qualities such as decency or honesty or his ability to provide for a family. But that's not enough anymore. Now we want to be inspired by our spouses daily. Step to it, honey. But this is exactly what I myself have expected in the past from love, inspiration, soaring bliss. And this is what I was now preparing to expect all over again, that we should somehow be answerable for every aspect of each other's joy and happiness, that our very job description as spouses was to be each other's everything. So I had always assumed, anyhow. And so I might have gone on blithely assuming, except that my encounter with the Hmong had knocked me off course in one critical regard. For the first time in my life, it occurred to me that perhaps I was asking too much of love, or at least perhaps I was asking too much of marriage. Perhaps I was loading a far heavier cargo of expectation onto the creaky old boat of matrimony that strange vessel had ever been built to accommodate in the first place.
Wow, that was a wonderful passage you read. I really enjoyed it. And it brings up many questions for me. I mean, first of all, I wonder, and maybe she talks about it in the book, how we came to this place where we expect that from our partners. From what little, you know, I just heard, it sounds like it wasn't always that way. Like, I wonder when that shift happened in our culture.
Yeah, you know what's funny? That's a great question. I'm like, now I can't remember if she explores so many different things and talks to different people. And I can't recall if that, I mean, I think there's kind of an exploration that leads up to that, but I can't quite say if she gets there, like right. How we've come to expect that. Or maybe I just distinctly remembered more because I understand that part, but that all of these weird things that it used to represent in the past, that I was just like, what? Why would anyone do that if it meant like you couldn't, you know, buy land or open a bank account without your husband's signature or permission? So right. There's all these just fascinating historical tidbits.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing that it made me, and I don't, maybe it seems a little bit too personal of a question, so feel free to, we can just blithely move on. But I was curious if it felt like something that felt true to you too, like when you were entering relationships, if that's kind of the expectation you had as well, and if maybe reading this book or just along your life's journey that's shifted over time or.
Yeah. What I loved about it is I came to this realization before I read this book. But I recognized and was so got what she was saying because I too had the same expectation. And I'd be like, oh, you know, like things aren't as magical as they used to be. It must mean we're out of love and should move on. And then I had my own like epiphany that thankfully didn't require going to Vietnam and visiting with Hmong people and a translator, that's not really a real expectation, and that a great relationship is work. And it's hard work, but it's amazing and beautiful and expansive. And so it was just kind of really cool to read from someone else that like, okay, yeah, a lot of people mistakenly have the wrong expectation. And I don't know, I like to think maybe they realize it's not the right expectation before they find the person that should be the one they're with for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. So.
And I think sometimes I feel like that phrase, like relationships are work or marriage is work, has kind of become tired, you know, like, that it doesn't really mean anything anymore. So I just like the reminder of what kind of work it is. Or it's not like, you know, work that you do at your job, you know, or like you really should be getting paid for this sort of thing. Like it's really this awful. Right. But it's actually something that you kind of want to do, that you discover that it's in the work of the relationship that it like expands and becomes something more beautiful or more interesting.
Right, yeah. It's like almost like we don't have a better word for it.
Yeah.
So you could think about it if you're really passionate about your work. You know, like a lot of us, I have various jobs and they're great and organizations and it's all good, but it's not what I'm passionate about. So mm-hmm. If you kind of think about it, like if the work you were doing is what you were meant to do and you're so passionate about, it's like that kind of work. Like this is, I want this relationship to thrive. So it is worth putting everything I have into it to make it be as beautiful as it can be and should be. And so mm-hmm. Like that's the work. But yeah, work kind of have, it's kind of like a dirty word.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't convey exactly what kind of work it is for a relationship.
Right. Maybe we need to work on that, coming up with a better word.
Better word for work.
Right. In this particular instance. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a great book and I'm intrigued. I might have to pick that one up. So thank you for bringing that today.
Yeah.
And what else did you bring today?
Well, this one I had a really hard time even figuring out what words to use to summarize it. So it's Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. So the author, Mary Roach, apparently wrote a really popular book called Stiff, where she looks at kind of the whole when you're dead.
Yeah.
Basically.
I think cadavers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I haven't read that one. And I can't even say what I'm often not attracted to very technical nonfiction. Like mm-hmm. sometimes I just get I get a little bored reading them. So I kind of brought like, ooh, I'll bring books that make me seem like I don't mostly read Pulp Fiction, but that's why I had to bring the last one in. But this one, it's amazing because she has so many strange, historical, scientific, it's like all of the research that people have done around sex, just from the beginning stages, and how awkward and weird, and how the scientists and their wives became the subjects because no one else would agree to do it. Yet she interjects this amazing humor. Like, I like the fact that you're kind of exploring with the author. You know, she's it's a lot of history, it's a lot of names, and but they're just so bizarre what people have done and still do around this topic, that it's fascinating. And always having her little, like, interjection of humor makes it a particularly fun read.
She is, I think, kind of known for this. I think my husband is reading a book by her right now called Gulp. So she, it seems like she likes to take a topic that's maybe a little bit, not difficult, but just kind of on the fringes, or like people don't talk about, like dead bodies, like cadavers, or the one he's reading now, I think, has a lot to do with like digestion and what we eat. And then sex, you know, has a little bit of a taboo. So it's not like in the, and she seems to just kind of yank it out of the shadows and like show it to everyone and talk about it. And it seems like,
Great. It's great. But there, I mean, most pages you're like, should I say that word on the radio? Would that make listeners uncomfortable? I'd talk about this with my friends and probably some strangers, but maybe not like Bron Gattest and like, hello out there.
I do notice you have some bookmarks, but maybe that's not really. Maybe
no, I have one. I have one that I decided was safe enough to read. So
we'll see
what everyone thinks about that. And so again, I'm kind of just like taking a piece out of it. She gives a little bit more about this doctor first, but we'll start with Shafiq Won My Heart by publishing a paper in European Urology in which he investigated the effects of polyester on sexual activity. Ahmed Shafiq dressed lab rats in polyester pants. There were 75 rats. They wore their pants for 1 year. Shafiq found that over time, the ones dressed in polyester or polycotton blend had sex significantly less often than the rats whose slacks were cotton or wool. Shafiq thinks the reason is that polyester sets up troublesome electrostatic fields in and around the genitals. Having seen an illustration of a rat wearing the pants, I would say there's an equal possibility that it's simply harder to get a date when you dress funny. So she has this, like, it's great. Like, you're learning, like, wow, some guy actually did that. And she, you know, interjects exactly what you would probably think if you saw this illustration. And so it's all, like, peppered throughout the book with that. And there, it's just, it's fascinating.
Oh my gosh, I can't imagine seeing a cage full of lab rats with polyester
pants. I know, right? Like, that's just kind of like a little sample of, and obviously it's way more fascinating and, I don't know, intriguing, uncomfortable when they get to actually, you know, human subjects.
Right.
So
I appreciate you, you know, just sticking with the rats there, especially because now I have this hilarious image in my head.
Can you go out throughout the day just picturing
little rats in polyester pants.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, hopefully they were stylish more than
I don't
know. Just,
I like picture like the old school polyester pants. You know, the ones that they're kind of like hiked up like past your belly button.
Yeah,
you got like. Yeah,
I think that might have something to do with the fact that they weren't getting as much action.
But you suspect as a control that the ones wearing the ones that are wool or cotton also had the exact same look, right? So they're all going to look funny.
Right.
So maybe something about the electrostatic. Yeah, so keep that in mind, fellas. Polyester pants, maybe not the best thing. I don't know. Maybe it's a feel thing, too. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should stop talking about what I think.
I feel like the listeners out there are really appreciating kind of this new sexual advice, you know, what clothes to choose for their, to make sure they have a lively love life.
Yeah, don't we always base stuff on, like, we do it on rats and then we somehow think, yeah, that applies to humans.
That works for us.
Why not?
Yeah. So, yeah, let's just segue right out of that, you know, it's kind of taboo topic to something else.
Yay, this is much lighter. And different. And so I used to be a voracious reader when I was a kid. Like, that's what I loved to do most, mostly about books that had animal characters, I think, because I was really shy. And so I had a hard time relating to people. But I was like, man, if animals could talk, like, we'd be like this. And I'm doing that, you know, symbol where you cross your fingers, which you can't see. So that's not helpful. But, you know, we'd be friends, like the critters and I. We got it going on. So now I read mostly when I'm traveling, because it's like you don't allow yourself the luxury somehow when you have to feel like you have to wake up to an alarm on your normal days. I like have a book that I read for months because I read about 5 pages and then I fall asleep, which I'm actually grateful for. I sleep well. Yeah. But what caught me when I run out of a book, because I don't want to carry too much in my bag when I'm traveling light, but this one was sitting on the shelf. And again, this is where like I wish you could see. There's this beautiful feather and it has this kind of gold shimmer to it. And it just says The Strange and Beautiful Sorrows of Ava Lavender on it, which just struck me. Mm-hmm. You know, you're kind of looking at all the faces of the books on the shelf. And I was like, I have never heard of this person, this book. And then you kind of read the first few pages. And it's just Pulp Fiction, really. You could say it's a silly little story, but it's amazing in that she writes about, it's just about a family and like interactions and, you know, how, you know, one person can't please their father. But it's so wrapped up in the way she writes about this girl who's born with wings. And, right, that's like fantasy realm, totally, mm-hmm. It not happening. But she writes it in a way that you're totally with it. Mm-hmm. You, like, just digest it. Like, okay, yeah, this girl has wings. And this is how she's, like, struggling to deal with it. And there's all these other relationship things that are going on. And I guess I just really appreciated the way, and I love reading fantasy books, mm-hmm. too. But this one, it wasn't full on fantasy. There was, like, this one fantastical thing about it. And everything else was so ordinary. And the way she just mixed them so well, made it really fun to read. Because you kind of think about, like, either you go the full fantasy route or you go the, okay, it's just a little bit of the unreal, mm-hmm. in this kind of ordinary people's lives.
It reminds me of there's a short story that Gabriel Garcia Marquez wrote about an angel that just appears on Earth. And the people responding to the angel. So kind of the same scenario of a fantastical thing that we haven't seen yet happen in our real world. But then that's the only part about it that's like fantastical or fantasy. The rest, mm-hmm. of it is just the regular world responding to it.
Yeah, and it has very real, you know, they're kept in their house, mm-hmm. shadowed away because their mom's like, whoa, the world can't deal with her brother's a little bit unique in different ways. And so it's like, they just don't ever leave their house until she's like 15. You know, because it's like, what do you do with a girl with these big brown wings? You know, and oh, I should have marked the page. She ends up with one friend who becomes her neighbor, and the neighbor just peers over the fence, and she's like, "So, what are you, like a bird or an angel or something?" And she's like, "I didn't have anything more as an 8-year-old to say, but I think I'm just a girl." Yeah. And so the other girl's like, "So, want me to come over and play with you or what?"
Aww,
and then she comes over and plays with her, and then she like convinces her that she should try to fly. You know, and so she like steps up on something and then she crashes to the ground and like skins her knee and is bleeding. And the girl's like, well, I guess you're not a bird. You know, birds have noses and all that, like don't have these particular features and they can fly. And
you can't fly.
And then she's like, so I guess you're just a girl after all. And she's like, how do you know I'm not an angel? And she's like, well, angels have white rings and yours are brown.
Which is super sweet.
That was just from memory, but I did pick a passage to read that doesn't really tell you anything so much about the characters in the book, but I just really liked it.
Well, let's hear it then, yeah.
And it kind of gives you an idea of the author's style. And so she writes, "Those born under Pacific Northwest skies are like daffodils. They can achieve beauty only after a long, cold sulk in the rain. Henry, our mother, and I were Pacific Northwest babies. At the first patter of raindrops on the roof, a comfortable melancholy settled over the house. The three of us spent dark, wet days wrapped in old quilts, sitting and sighing at the watery sky. Vivian, with her acute gift for smell, could close her eyes and know the season just by the smell of the rain. Summer rain smelled like newly clipped grass, like mouths stained red with berry juice, blueberries, raspberries, blackberries. It smelled like late nights spent pointing constellations out from their starry guises, freshly washed laundry drying outside on the line, like barbecues and stolen kisses in a 1932 Ford coupe." So yeah, just a little ditty of...
Well, I think that's a great passage that you read because probably many of us can relate to that here with the rain.
Yeah.
Well, I actually have to wrap it up because we are out of time right now. Thank you, Brandy, for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me.